The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
And it's time now for the debrief. We're going to take a look back on the week that was and a look ahead to the weekend. So I'm joined in the studio by consumer columnist with the Irish Independent and presenter of The Home Show here on News Talk, Sinead Ryan. I'm also joined by political correspondent with the Irish Times, Jack Horgan-Jones, and motoring editor with the Sunday Independent, Ger Herbert. Lovely to have you all here. Morning. Thanks for coming in. So listen, it feels like such a long time ago, but it is only this week, St. Patrick's Day, and Micheál Martin in the White House. And Jack, I'll start with you, because just good to get the political take on this. First of all, you think he got out the gap, do you, with the whole Trump interaction and everybody holding their breath as to how it would go?
Yes, and it was written all over his face the closer he got to the end that he could sense that he was getting closer to the gap. The gap was emerging. I think that it went probably about as well as it could have gone, particularly when you consider the type of politician that Micheál Martin is. You know, he's cautious by nature. I don't think we're ever going to get a kind of Hugh Grant sticking it up to Billy Bob Thornton in
Love Actually.
But Love Actually, thank
yeah.
you.
We're never going to get that kind of that moment.
No.
Yeah.
Watching it, I was working on Wednesday remotely. I wasn't over in the Oval Office, but I was watching it and I kind of, at the start, I think, geez, he's not talking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for like 20 minutes. He didn't speak effectively for the first 20 minutes. So I think in those first interactions, his team would have been actually quite glad with, you know, the fact that Trump was kind of being baited by things that weren't really in Ireland's wheelhouse. He's banging on about NATO. He was giving out about this intelligence official that had resigned that morning. Not really things that Micheál Martin might reasonably have expected to interject on. But when it came to the Starmer stuff, I think that he had to speak up, and he did. And he did it in a relatively tactful way, in a way that didn't immediately provoke a backlash from Donald Trump, because like the risk of this guy is he could say anything. And we saw that the very next day when he had the Japanese prime minister and he made a joke about Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was kind of funny in the moment, mm-hmm. but like it's humiliating for the Japanese PM. And that's always the risk.
You were keeping an eye then on the reaction back home, you know, because the opposition are always waiting, aren't they, in the not so long grass after these sorts of events. So how did you assess that reaction?
And I thought it was instructive, the fact that they didn't sprint out of the gates immediately afterwards. It suggested to me that there was no kind of grievous political error on a domestic front that he had committed in there, which rendered him immediately vulnerable to criticism. Now, the criticism, of course, did come, particularly the comment that he made, which was ill-advised, I think, around Donald Trump doing his bit for peace in the Middle East,
when
we know
exactly
the role that the United States has played there. But I think in the grand pantheon of errors that he could have made or ways in which this could have gone down, it was relatively minor. And again, I don't think it was raised in leaders' questions in the Dáil this week. So again, I think that the assessment of the opposition, it tells you something. They don't think that this guy has all of a sudden a weak political underbelly to attack over the Oval Office. I did think one thing was interesting as well. I mean, if you look at the structure of the day on Patrick's Day across all the engagements in the White House and on Capitol Hill, the Oval Office interaction is the point of extreme danger. And you could see when Trump invited questions, Micheál Martin did a big inhale as though he was bracing himself for what could happen, because he can't control it.
Can you imagine what it's like?
But you can control the Shamrock ceremony, which is the speechifying at the very end of the day. And I think that Micheál Martin saved some of his more pointed, now not necessarily very pointed, but messages around de-escalation in the Gulf, messages around Ireland's support for the United Nations, things that like are actually contrary to Trump's policy agenda. He saved it for that because it's more structured. Also, you speak after Trump there, so you can't respond to the things you're saying.
But J.D. Vance, of course, had the socks on again. I think they were a little bit more muted this time. But we'd Matt Frye on the program and he was talking about how silent J.D. Vance has been about what's happening in Iran. Mm. And he said he's in a witness protection program. And I was laughing to myself thinking, well, Micheál Martin has seen him and he knows what his new identity is, so we can take that as read. What did you think of it all, Sinead?
I think he navigated. It's a bit like somebody going across a raging torrent of a river on stepping stones, and you kind of know they're going to get to the other side safely, but there's always that danger they may fall off or the stone may break. I think he navigated it by doing what he does best, which is that quiet, diplomatic discourse that we've come to expect from pretty much every world leader, presidents, Taoiseach, over the years, this should be a normal, nice day out. It's only in the last administration and this one where it has turned otherwise. I think he did a very good job. I don't think, sticking up for Starmer and Churchill was on his bingo card going in there, but he navigated that quite
well. Could he have done more?
He could have done more. Listen, he could have said, we are totally against this war in Iran. It's an absolute disaster. And why don't you get the hell out? But, you know, to what end? So Trump comes back and he said, right, 200% tariff on everything coming from Ireland. Like, is that what make, you know, then you'd have the opposition coming into the Dáil saying, well, that was a complete cluster mess. And how the hell did that happen? And what were you thinking?
So you've got to stay on the stepping stones.
He has to come out. Like, the win here was always going to be to come out unscathed with a smile on your face. That was it. That was done. He did that last year. He did it this year.
Okay. Do you think it was a win, Ger?
Yeah, I do, to be honest. I mean, I think he was always going to face criticism at home that he didn't do enough or it was a missed opportunity. I think he did. He pushed back nicely, gently, in as much as he could. I don't think you're going to win any battles with Trump in the Oval Office. And as Sinead said, I think, you know, the reprisals can be much stronger. I thought what Jack was saying about for the first 20 minutes, he said nothing, but the meeting itself was 40 minutes. It was a long old time to sit there and, you know, hold your tongue. So I think for the second 20 minutes, he did as much as he could. So, yeah. And I think internationally as well, it was well received.
Of course, he's coming back now to face into these demands to address the energy crisis. I know you'll be keeping a close eye on this with the professional hat on. You saw what Spain did this morning. They're going to reduce the VAT now from 21% to 10% on fuel. There's going to be huge pressure on the government to do something here. They are going to take some measures on Tuesday. We just don't know what they are. I mean, what do you think needs to happen?
I think they have to take some measures, and I think the expectation is there. They did this before for the Ukraine crisis, so people are expecting this to happen. Yeah. I think the one thing about excise, it's not ideal from their point of view because it's very hard to roll back on. And we saw that before. It took three incremental changes to actually restore it back to where it was when they cut it the last time. But it does have an immediate effect, and I think that's what people want. The other thing as well is I think people still feel aggrieved about the budget. They don't feel like an awful lot was done for them. In fact, there was very little, if anything. So from that point of view, I think excise is probably the easiest to do because it has the most impact. But I mean, they have said targeted. I presume fuel allowances will be extended. Mm-hmm. The fuel allowance will be extended. But I think something, you know, people just have become to realise now that once fuel goes over €2, something has to happen. And I think if they don't reduce excise, you know, there will be.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's that news this morning that we could have faced €800 on electricity. Mm-hmm. If you're a gas user, €800 on your gas bill as well. That's incredible on top of high prices already.
It is. But the difficulty is now that any move that's going to take place is being done outside the budgetary cycle. And it's very, very expensive. So, I mean, the government has options here on the tax side because so much of fuel is tax based on the, say, the petrol and diesel side. But the much bigger issue is the home heating bills, the electricity, and particularly kerosene, because there's that's much, much higher in price. That's the home heating oil, because there's no refineries that can deal with that here. That's why that's much more expensive.
And we've 320,000 people in arrears.
In arrears already.
Already before this increase comes.
One in seven households, Claire. And really, this is a huge issue for people because the regulator here, the CRU, I mean, it carries a fairly hefty stick, and it has told suppliers not cut people off, certainly not in the winter months, that's over now, and to make sure that they plan out a repayment bill over up to 48 months if needs be. The difficulty is that it's enormously inflationary to start offering subsidies. They were inflationary when they did them pre-election, and they're going to be now, so it just knocks everything else out of kilter around it. Of course there's scope to do it, but it's not easy, and it's not as simple as it might appear, which is just cut this, add this, give us this.
Yeah, Colin Thomas was in earlier on, we were talking about this, and his view is that whatever happens, Jack, it'll be short term. It'll be for a few weeks so that they can pull it back quickly. Do you agree with that? Or do you think on the energy bill side, there's going to have to be something a little more substantial, maybe less targeted at this stage if we are looking at 1600 across the board for every average household energy user?
So I suppose the thing about energy bills, about domestic and energy bills, is that shoe doesn't really drop, I think, because they're lucky in terms of the time of the year that it's happening. That shoe won't drop until, you know, autumn, early winter. Like if people are being very unfortunately hit with this enormous bill for home heating oil at the moment. It's probably their last fill before the cold months come back in. So I think that buys the coalition a little bit of time before they have to make a decision on, you know, do we have to go ahead on something broad-based like an electricity credit again, which they have firmly ruled out in the short term, and gets them closer to the actual budgetary cycle, budget day itself. So that's when I think that decision point may emerge, and we'll see where we are there with regards to the conflict in the Gulf. I think that it's correct to say that whatever is done now, it seems to me that there will be a large degree of contingency attached to this. So it was interesting to see the Taoiseach and obviously the Minister for Finance, Simon Harris, talking in the Dáil yesterday about how Italy has agreed to lower excise, but only for a period of 20 days.
Yes.
That's interesting. And when you look around Europe, there's all these kind of contingencies built into a lot of the interventions. So I think there's one in Austria where the excise drops, but only when the price point hits a certain amount. So there's a relationship between the policy action and, mm-hmm. and the market effect. So what they're trying to do, I suppose, around Europe, but also in Ireland, is get away from this kind of politically dangerous cliff edge, which we saw with things like VAT 9 going all the way back through. I mean, even pre-COVID, this was a recession-era intervention that they struggled to put away for years, did again during COVID, eventually got it put away. And, you know, these things are very politically tricky to take away. So if you can think of a mechanism, perhaps, that kind of takes the political decision-making yeah. point out of it or lessens the political pain, that might be something they find attractive in the short term.
There's also the policing aspect. You know, I think there's consumers have this feeling, and it's not unwarranted, that, you know, who's going to monitor that these reductions take place if there is a subsidy given mm. in terms of tax or excise? Because, you know, you're driving around, and Ger will have seen this, garage to garage to garage, it's 199, 170, you know, 189, 192, all over the place. And it's like, if that went up or down by 4 cents, like the driver has no sense that somebody's in charge.
It's demand driven, isn't it?
I mean, this is like government is very fond of talking about price gouging because it's politically expedient for them to do that. And I have no doubt that there is gouging going mm-hmm. on. But also, you know, we have set up the market in a way that the regulatory arm of the state that is the most powers they have are on price setting and collusion as opposed to setting the price in a collusive yeah. way, as opposed to identifying what price you have to pay, you have to charge because of your wholesale costs going up and what you think customers will pay. I mean, they would say that's the market functioning. Mm-hmm. And we're downstream here of wholesale energy markets, and they're spiking in a really dramatic way, and there is no getting away from that.
Does anyone wish that the EU would develop a backbone, though, when it comes to dealing with Donald Trump in all of this? Because we are paying the bill for his decision to unilaterally head in there.
And we
with
had
Israel.
No say in it.
We no say in it. No yeah. say in it at
I
all.
I think there's a concern about the tit for tat nature that it could become. So if the EU comes out, and remember, the EU isn't just one president, you know, the way Trump is. You know, it's much, much more a collegiate and collective body. It's slower as a result of coming out and saying, right, we're going to slap tariffs on the US now because of this thing. Then that is just grist to the mill. Now, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do something, mm-hmm. but you can see that the reaction, the knee-jerkness of the current White House administration is we'll double it, we'll triple it, we'll quadruple it.
I know, but it comes back to that thing. How do you deal with a bully? You know, and if you do not stand up to him, like Pedro Sanchez made a good fist of it at the start of all of this, the Spanish PM, but nobody really came along and said, yeah, we're going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you here. So if we continue to live in fear of Donald Trump, it's the same as sitting with him in the Oval Office and not saying anything.
Yeah,
you know?
It's the same thing. I mean, we're commending Micheál Martin for not antagonising him. And at the same time, we feel collectively we should be doing something. And I think that's the bind that we're in. But I mean, the question goes back to what Sinead said. To what end would that have got us?
I know.
And
we don't know where it'll lead to. I get that argument.
And he's too unpredictable in that yeah. sense.
And when I'm talking to multinationals, people involved in multinationals, what their sense of this is, we need to ride out what's now left of this. It's not about coming up against him and beating it and trying to push back.
Ride out the next 2 years.
Ride out the next, well, three, yeah. Ride out this administration. Now, of course, you mentioned Vance earlier. We don't know. That's a very unknown factor. What happens if Vance becomes the president? All that. I think he's Trump with a brain, to be perfectly honest. But who knows? But yeah, the sense seems to be just make it stop. Just.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of the riddle facing policymakers and governments around the world. I'm sure everyone will have seen the Mark Carney speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, where he spoke about effectively the kind of transatlantic or the Western consensus breaking down. And I think that political leaders, they can know that intellectually, but how do you respond to that, particularly in the short term, tactically? You know, you're not really, you don't have a whole suite of options when you're so embedded into the system as it stands. I mean, one thing Europe can do, but again, it's not in the short term, is pursue more energy independence and more renewable energy, and all that is very good. But again, it's not a short term lever you can pull.
Okay, now I am going to move to something completely different: sex scenes and the movies, which is equally as important. So everyone has a memory, don't they, of watching a movie with your parents, and suddenly everybody takes their clothes off on the screen, and you're sitting there deeply uncomfortably. So Carol Midgley was writing about this in the London Times. She said, "Look, they're so bad, they're so awful, they're so uncomfortable, just ditch them. Stop doing them. Stop putting them in." What do you think, Sinead?
Okay, so I was on holiday, I think last two years ago. It's memorable for this reason. I was walking, big long walk on the beach one morning, and I strayed onto what I didn't realise inadvertently was a nudist beach.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had all their bits out. Now, thankfully, I was on my own. I didn't have small kids with me. It was pretty awful, Claire. There was nothing about
I've had this, I've walked onto a nudist
beach
before.
There's nothing about it that's edifying, that's sexy, that's pretty. The whole sexiness comes from the reveal, comes from what's not shown, in my view. And the older I get, the more entrenched in that position I become. Wobbly bits are not good, like unless you're a supermodel. And even then, it's questionable. So I am all for stopping the camera action, you know, a bit like Jane Austen. Just stop it just before and come to the following morning. Like, we're all adults here, right? We can use our imagination. And the joy of reading a book, for instance, is as opposed to a graphic movie, is that you get to
leave
do
out the sexy
that.
Bits.
Get
Sinead,
rid of it.
Jack?
Look, I'm not against it in principle. I know that you were talking about this during the week, and there's mention of heated rivalry, which a lot of people found was a bit too heated for their taste. But like, you know,
actual porn. That was actual porn. I watched two episodes of it.
I'm not sure I agree.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I did watch it all. Yeah. Like, I thought it was interesting because it obviously showed same-sex sex in a way and a level that we're not used to seeing, like, and it made you think a little bit about, like, why don't we see same
sex? It was pretty graphic. I mean, I don't care what gender, it was pretty full on, you know, and it was the whole thing. Like, there was a few scenes where they had their clothes on, but the rest of it.
I do think a good strategy on this would perhaps be to increase the cost to filmmakers of making bad sex scenes. There's a thing the Literary Review in the UK does, Bad Sex Writing Awards, every year, where authors who write terrible sex scenes are shamed in front of all their other colleagues.
That's
Yeah, exactly. So I think if they did something like that for filmmaking, maybe increase the costs professionally of doing a bad job, but you
so
might
Sinead
get, you might
says
get a more
no sex.
Take.
Jack says better sex. Ger, what do you say?
Yeah, I'm not in favour of banning them completely. I think that's a step too far. I don't particularly like them when they're just box ticking and you just think, oh, come on, you know, we could have done without that. But I mean, the idea that they don't further the plot, they're not supposed to further the plot. They're like car chases. They're like fight scenes. They're about evoking a reaction from the audience. And I think a lot of times they do that. So I don't have an issue with that. But as I said, my problem is when they're just purely there for no reason at all, then it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. But banning them, I think that is a step too far.
It is something people do.
We'll have more people heading to heated rivalry, though, as a result of that conversation, I would say. Listen, thank you all very much for coming in, Jack and Ger and Sinead. My thanks to all of you for getting in touch over the course of the morning and indeed the week. You can listen back at anything you might have missed on the Go Loud app. Huge thanks to the team, who are the hardest working team in radio: Cormac McDonagh on sound, producers Helena O'Toole, Dee King and Alex Russo, research by David O'Connor, our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie Kane, and our editor is Denise McNamara.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.